It is Wednesday, July 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United Nations Security Council prepares to meet on the North Korean military threat following Pyongyang's first successful missile test this week.
This missile only had about a 6,500-kilometer range from what people are estimating, which would allow them to reach parts of Alaska, but certainly not to either Hawaii or the continental United States.
Turkey's opposition leader prepares to challenge the government's crackdown, and new awards recognize the best high school musical performances. It's all ahead. As the UN Security Council prepares once again to discuss a North Korean missile test, leader Kim Jong-un said Wednesday Pyongyang will not place its nuclear or its missile program on the negotiating table. Quoting Kim, this KRT newsreader said the North will not flinch even one inch from the road to bolster its nuclear force unless the U.S. hostile policy and nuclear threat to North Korea are terminated. On Tuesday, the North said it successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile, an assessment shared by South Korea, and the U.S. state-run media described Kim as feasting his eyes on the ICBM, which it said is capable of carrying a large nuclear warhead. Kim is quoted as urging his scientists to send big and small gift packages to the Yankees. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the test a new escalation of the threat to the United States and called for action to halt a global threat. U.S. and South Korean forces Wednesday fired off deep-strike precision missiles into South Korean territorial waters as a show of force. The Hwasong-14 missile was assessed to have reached an altitude of about 2,800 kilometers and a distance of 900 kilometers before falling into the Sea of Japan. Some experts said the missile is capable of reaching Alaska, but RAND Corporation defense analyst Bruce Bennett tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he's cautious about the true extent of the North Korean threat.
We do have to remember, though, that this missile only had about a 6,500-kilometer range from what people are estimating, which would allow them to reach parts of Alaska, but certainly not to either Hawaii or the continental United States. So they've still got a ways to go before they really have a threat to the United States other than in Alaska.
Well, what about the speed with which they are testing? Are you surprised that the advancement is coming so quickly?
It is a little surprising, but not entirely. I mean, we usually assume that North Korea is doing this all by themselves, that they're not getting any foreign help. And yet I think there's every reason to believe that they probably have some scientists from perhaps Russia, perhaps China, who have worked on developing this kind of missile and are providing information on what a warhead looks like and how it gets through the atmosphere. So I think it's not at all surprising that they've made these advances.
One analyst, Patrick Cronin, an Asia expert with the Center for New American Security, said President Trump is probably, quote, coming to the point of no return with North Korea, adding the upshot could be diplomatic overtures or military action. Where are we in this process?
Don't know for sure because President Trump hasn't said, but let's face it. You have to ask, are we better letting North Korea develop hundreds of nuclear weapons and threatening South Korea with those and telling South Korea to surrender to North Korea for it to take over South Korea? Do we really want to wait for that, or do we want to confront North Korea sooner? It's a hard trade-off, but we may have to face a military confrontation that leads to war sooner or later, and it's probably better if it's sooner because of the growing threat.
Do you anticipate Trump administration will have to revise its policy toward North Korea?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is going to have to now give North Korea a choice. They can choose to stop this behavior, or the U.S. is going to start turning, I would think, to various forms of seeking for the regime to change. So far, the United States has been clear that we were not going to push for regime change. But North Korea is putting the United States in a very difficult position where we may have to consider that alternative. That's been very foolish of North Korea to do that.
RAND Corporation defense analyst Bruce Bennett. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump assailed China on Wednesday for boosting its trade with North Korea. In a Twitter comment, Trump said trade between China and North Korea grew almost 40% in the first quarter. So much for China working with us, but we had to give it a try. Well, joining me is social media editor Doug Bernard with a look at what's trending. So, Doug, what's happening?
Well, there's lots to talk about. These big news stories, the G20 meeting, North Korea's missile tests, lots of people talking back and forth. But today I have a story that actually involves the news and social media. So yesterday, as our listeners may know, was the 4th of July Independence Day. And every year on that day, National Public Radio here in the United States features their hosts and anchors and reporters reading the Declaration of Independence. For those who haven't read it, it is a little long, but it's essentially, you know, a bill of grievances against the king and how he was treating the colonies. So this year they also took to Twitter and they tweeted out the Declaration of Independence on anniversary of its signing, and this has apparently angered a lot of Trump supporters, because maybe they just don't know it was the Declaration of Independence, but now they're assuming that NPR is calling for the overthrow of President Trump. Here's just a couple examples out on Twitter. So in response to this one, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, that, of course, from the Declaration of Independence. Somebody responding, so NPR is calling for revolution. Interesting way to condone the violence while trying to sound patriotic. Here is another tweet from the Independence Declaration, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. That, of course, referencing the King of England, and somebody responding, yes, NPR journalists with a mission. Somebody else replying to NPR here saying, propaganda, is that all you know? Try supporting a man who wants to do something about the injustice in the country. So it's curious, I think.
Yeah, it is. I was just going to say, yes, Doug, it is curious because this was written in 1776 and it concerns King George III.
Exactly. So that's 25 or whatever years old. And maybe it's a sign that people are not as familiar with their founding documents as they ought to be. Or maybe it's also a sign that I think on social media, people may just hear what they are expecting to hear. So somebody, if a Trump supporter is expecting to hear somebody being critical of Donald Trump, they're going to sort of naturally jump to that conclusion, which I think, again, is a great reminder for just all of us to be very thoughtful and clear and calm about what we're seeing on social media and not jumping the gun.
Yeah, well, and I think that, the NPR has for a number of years now featured the reading of the Declaration of Independence. Perhaps that seeing this on Twitter is perhaps what, you know, generated this sort of latest flap.
I think so, and I think perhaps, you know, maybe when they air it, it's a long reading, a patriotic music underneath and all that kind of thing. It's great to hear. I love listening to it every year. Maybe Twitter is not the way to go because, you know, it's just these short little tiny bursts. And maybe it's too easy to lose context, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps. All right. Well, thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will visit Ukraine. Qatar blames Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for its crisis while its rivals meet in Cairo. German Chancellor Angela Merkel stands firm on her position that Europe cannot rely fully on the United States, and a Colombian UN hostage is released. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that modern humans may be more closely related anatomically to a species of great apes called the bonobo than the chimpanzee. Researchers from two Washington, D.C. universities made their findings after examining and comparing the muscular systems of the three species. Past research, including a gene sequencing conducted back in 2012, found that both chimpanzees and bonobos share 99% of our DNA. Bernard Wood from George Washington University is one of the three authors of the study. He says that bonobos are the closest we can get to a living ancestor since their muscles haven't changed as much as the common chimpanzee. Scientists think that the modern human split from the common chimpanzee bonobo ancestry about 8 million years ago, with the two great ape species splitting about 2 million years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, American High School Musical performers compete for recognition. The leader of Turkey's main opposition party has pledged to continue his campaign for justice in the face of government accusations of supporting terrorism. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who's leading a 25-day justice march from Ankara to Istanbul, spoke with Dorian Jones, who reports for VOA from Istanbul.
The head of Turkey's main opposition, Republican People's Party, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, is leading thousands of people on a 450-kilometer justice march from the capital, Ankara, to the country's largest city, Istanbul. The march is in response to a year-long crackdown following last July's failed coup attempt. The crackdown has resulted in more than 100,000 people losing their jobs and more than 60,000 jailed. Kılıçdaroğlu told VOA the protest was triggered by the jailing of fellow parliamentary deputy and close ally Enes Berbaoğlu for 25 years on charges of releasing state secrets.
Olağanüstü kararname yetkisiyle birlikte bir sivil darbe oldu.
He says the introduction of a state of emergency decree was a civil coup. All the negative outcomes of this civilian coup came one after the other, he said, adding, members of parliament and journalists were arrested and academics dismissed from their positions. He says Berbaoğlu's arrest became the moment when the water overspilled the glass and his party made the decision to march. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his government have repeatedly condemned the march, saying it supports terrorism and coup plotters. Despite the criticism, the numbers joining the march continue to grow, with around 10,000 marching with Kılıçdaroğlu. He expects those numbers will grow by the time the march concludes Sunday in Istanbul. But Kılıçdaroğlu promised the march is only the beginning and civil protests will not end.
Her türlü çabayı göstereceğiz. Her türlü mücadeleyi yapacağız.
He says the struggle will continue with all possible effort and within democracy and using all the force the party has in parliament and outside parliament. Amid rising political tensions over the march, a heavy police presence has been deployed to protect demonstrators, particularly Kılıçdaroğlu. Police have said they have detained six people linked to Islamic State who were planning to carry out an attack on the march. Kılıçdaroğlu said he and the marchers have faced threats and provocations. The march is due to end Sunday at the prison where Berbaoğlu is serving his prison sentence. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
A Chinese hospital is inviting cancer specialists from the United States and Germany to help in its treatment of imprisoned dissident and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo. The Judicial Bureau for the northeastern city of Shenyang, where Liu is being treated, said Wednesday the hospital issued the invitation after Liu's family made the request and after consulting with the 61-year-old's medical team. Liu was granted medical parole in May after he was diagnosed with late-stage kidney cancer. The decision comes just 2 days after Germany urged China to allow Liu to travel abroad to receive treatment for his illness. Beijing claims the ailing dissident is too sick to leave the country. But Hu Jia, Liu's friend and fellow dissident, says a video that emerged on YouTube last weekend appeared to indicate that Liu was in stable condition. Liu is a poet and human rights activist who was arrested after writing Charter 08, a manifesto calling for democratic reforms in China, and awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010 for his campaign for democracy and human rights. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison for inciting subversion of state power, a law often used by Chinese authorities to silence dissidents. Foreign governments and human rights groups have urged China to allow Liu to travel abroad to seek treatment wherever he chooses. Human Rights Watch researcher Maya Wang told VOA she does not see this as a concession by Chinese authorities. She was asked if she was surprised that the new U.S. ambassador to China made this request.
Perhaps it is a bit surprising, I mean, given the fact that he had branded himself as kind of a good personal friend of Xi Jinping, and all the indications suggested that under the Trump administration that the U.S. doesn't seem to be very interested in pressing China on human rights issues. But I think it is positive that he started by, you know, mentioning Liu Xiaobo and asking the Chinese government to free him for treatment abroad. Now we just need to see how this is going to actually pan out, as in would the U.S. government actually put enough actual pressure on the Chinese government to free Liu Xiaobo. We want to see collective action by governments around the G20 to make sure that China lets Liu Xiaobo go.
Wang added that the case of Liu Xiaobo is one of the most visible and serious rights violations by the Chinese government since the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
The dream of performing on Broadway.
This is International Edition. You've heard of the Oscar Awards for the best in film, of course, and probably the Tonys celebrating the best on Broadway. Now get ready for the Jimmy Awards, which were handed out last week. Named for the late Broadway theater owner and producer James Nederlander, they're given to the best high school musical theater performers in the United States. Reporter Jeff London followed two of them as they got ready to take center stage on Broadway.
The dream of performing on Broadway came true for 74 high school actors, singers, and dancers, selected from 50,000 young performers across the United States. They came to New York for the National High School Musical Theater Awards.
Welcome to New York!
They jumped right in, learning the opening medley for a show they would perform on Broadway in just 1 week. Seventeen-year-old Felix Torres came from Green Bay, Wisconsin. He qualified for the Jimmys by playing the Beast in Beauty and the Beast at his high school.
Being here already is an award itself. Being able to perform on Broadway as a high schooler, I just want to soak it all in.
18-year-old Jasmine Rogers from Houston, Texas, did too. She played the witch in Into the Woods. Unlike Felix, she's seen many Broadway shows.
I didn't get into musical theater until I was 7. I used to play the violin, and I was bad at it, by the way. And one day a flyer came home to do a production of Peter Pan. And so I auditioned, and I fell in love with it from there on, and I've been doing it since.
For 8 days, these teenagers were pushed hard. Only a few days after that first rehearsal, they had staged the opening number. Keisha LaLama, the show's choreographer, says she expects a lot.
You know, if you treat them like professionals and really just challenge them to rise up, they do. And that's what I think is so amazing about it, is that these kids are willing and able. And if you provide them with the opportunity, they can thrive.
One of those opportunities is that each participant is coached by a Broadway actor. Howard McGillin, who's done more performances of The Phantom of the Opera than anyone in history, coached Felix.
Time before you sing the last title of the song?
Monday morning was dress rehearsal.
Take your positions. I just want you to see exactly what's going to happen so everybody's got it in their head.
Just a few hours later, the curtain went up before a sold-out house on Broadway.
The heat is on in New York. The heat is on in New York.
Felix donned his Beast costume and sang his solo.
No spirit could win me, and no hope left within me.
Then the finalists were announced.
Now the ladies, the finalists are, from the Tommy Tune Awards in Houston, Texas, Jasmine Rogers.
And so in front of friends, family, and a lot of important Broadway producers and casting directors, Jasmine sang all alone in a spotlight, center stage.
All I have to do is pretend I never knew him. On those very rare occasions when he steals into my heart.
She didn't win the Best Actress award, but the experience itself was the prize. Both Jasmine Rogers and Felix Torres said they made new friends, polished their performing skills, and came away with a confidence that they would definitely be back on Broadway. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recently concluded session of the UN Human Rights Council, the U.S. played a key role in shaping the international response to urgent human rights situations. In several speeches, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley highlighted the need for reform of the Human Rights Council, or HRC, to make it more effective and accountable, including by eliminating the biased agenda item focused solely on Israel. She underscored the need for the HRC to focus international attention and action on the worst human rights violators, including through reforms to the Council's membership. In particular, the United States joined consensus on a resolution establishing an international team that will investigate reports of the atrocities occurring in the Kasai provinces of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The U.S. issued a strong statement calling for the government of the DRC to cooperate with the investigation, provide unhindered access to all areas of the country, ensure the safety of all who cooperate with the investigation, including victims and witnesses, and ensure accountability for all perpetrators of human rights violations and abuses. On Venezuela, the United States co-sponsored a side event to draw attention to the deteriorating human rights situation there. Following the event, the United States condemned reprisals by the Venezuelan delegation against two of the participants. In support of gender equality, the United States joined consensus on resolutions on eliminating violence against women and discrimination against women and girls. The U.S. also co-sponsored resolutions to extend the mandate of the special rapporteurs on trafficking in persons and on child, early, and forced marriage in humanitarian settings. The United States co-sponsored a resolution on the egregious violations and abuses of human rights in Syria. The U.S. also co-sponsored a resolution welcoming the Ukrainian government's cooperation with UN human rights monitors. The United States continued its support for the mandates of the special rapporteurs on Belarus and on the situation of human rights in Eritrea, and supported a presidential statement on Côte d'Ivoire to encourage continued cooperation between the government and the UN on human rights. The United States' work on the HRC demonstrates that it will never give up the cause of universal human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.